Hey, everyone. Welcome to Taking It Down. If this is your first time to listen, we're the Alabama Takes Pop Culture Discussion Podcast. You're now listening to Episode 7. We've made it this far, and in dog years that we're, you know, we're 49, I think. And as always, I'm your host, Blaine Duncan. Today, I'm going to be joined by first-time guest, Donovan Reinwald. It's going to be a good one. He and I are going to talk about the music and the art and the artistry of Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires. I'm actually fresh off a trip from Chattanooga this past weekend where I got a chance to see them and the Trillbillies. Shout out to those folks, those really good guys and gal who have a radical, excellent, hilarious podcast. And I also saw the Bohannons there. It was a great show. And Donovan and I will get into that in just a second. And a bit later on, right after the mid-break, both Donovan and I are going to talk about, break down our thoughts on the Netflix show Unbelievable, which dropped back Friday, September 13th. So hopefully everyone's had time to catch up on that. All right. Let's get into Taking It Down.
Sounds great. I'd actually like to push back a little bit on you with dog ears. Depending on some breeds, your dog might already be dead, not 49.
Mm.
Like if you have a boxer or something.
Well, that's a great segue.
I think it is, isn't it? Like, if you have one of those really lovable dogs, yeah, those die young.
Yeah, okay. You know, the first half of the podcast is not going to... Well, no, the back half of the podcast is not going to be as pleasant. So, actually, the first half could be quite pleasant. We're going to... this is Donovan Reinwald. Donovan, hello. Any introductions we need, you think?
Let me just be a mystery.
Okay. Donovan is a mystery, and we'll leave it at that. But one thing, though, I'm sitting here in my Glory Fires t-shirt, fresh off of seeing them and the Trillbillies and the Bohannons Friday night. And you're going to go see them later in this same tour as they head up north, right?
I'm so excited for that. Yeah, they're going to be in Hartford, Connecticut, not Colorado, or wherever there might be a Hartford. Yeah, not this week, but next week. And
October, like 7th or 8th or 9th or 10th or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's the 9th.
So Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires, if you're listening and you're in those areas, they're going to be in the Northeast, Brooklyn, Boston, Hartford, those areas. But if listeners have never heard of Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires, how would you describe them?
You know, I was thinking about that. I just actually went and re-listened to that most recent album that came out, Youth Detention. And I was trying to think about how would I, because I've also been over the past couple of weeks trying to sell my friends on coming with me, and they are coming with me. But you know, my go-to is kind of like, yeah, they're kind of punky, like they, but that's not really. And they are, but I don't feel like now, re-listening to this one today, really trying to, oh, someone's going to make me defend my opinions in about 45 minutes. It's almost like punk is a cool undercurrent in it, but you've also got, there's such a, the thing that popped into my head is there's such a rhythm band. They've got such a cool beat that runs through it. They're absolutely a rock band, right? Like they're playing off of kind of this cool Southern rock tradition, but they're kind of flipping it on its head and giving it a punk, almost kind of like what the Clash did, where it's like we're gonna play around a little bit with what you're expecting here. We might throw some weird stuff in.
Yeah, had the Clash been born in Birmingham, Alabama?
Absolutely.
I don't disagree with that. They're I think of them as a Southern punk rock with heavy on melody. I think punk is definitely part of the artistry, though. That's part of what you get with them. That's like part of the statement.
Yeah. It's, you know, I was going back and I was thinking it's punk in the sense that like it's high energy and it's somewhat simple. And it's also, maybe simple's not the right word, but you know, it's not, you're not sitting down and listening to a Joanna Newsom record, right? Like it's something that I think if you played it for almost anyone, they'd be like, oh yeah, okay, I sort of know what this is. Mm-hmm. And then of course, so deep in the, because the lyrics are actually really good and I think really important to the band, right? Because it's not just, and at least at the shows that I've seen, like the music is cool and fun, but it's also what we're talking about, responding to, pushing back against, informing people about. That's kind of the real punk DNA for me.
I think maybe what you meant by simple is that it's not going to be, I mean, there are riffs and things that I would not be able to play on guitar. And so maybe simple in the terms of it's a 3 or 4 minute song, and you're going to have your standard 1-4-5 chord structure, but you're right. It is the lyrics that are important. In fact, I would say their music is, I was thinking about this Friday night as I was watching them, their music is as much a movement and part of this ongoing revolution that's as much as with those heightened lyrics that,
yeah,
and they really demand introspection. And I hope that doesn't sound too academic or pedantic, but because it's also toe-tapping and a great blend of some Southern rock that you might hear in maybe the Allman Brothers on occasion. You might hear tidbits of that in their music.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I was trying to think of like simple is probably not the best word to use, but I kind of was thinking like simple in the sense that like a Ramones song is simple and catchy, right? But
exactly,
these guys,
yeah,
know their stuff, because if you're sitting there and listening, and they're again, I was sitting out and listening to that their most recent record, Youth Detention, where they're actually kind of, you know, they've got a lot of the 2 and 3 minute songs, but you're also getting some of these longer ones like Crooked Letters or even Nail My Feet Down to the South Side of Town, which is great.
Yeah.
And the other thing I really like about, so I forget what label this one came out on, the most recent one, but the first one, Deconstruction, that came out on Sub Pop, I actually liked the mix on Youth Detention a lot better, because I found, yeah, for the Sub Pop one, the guitars and stuff were up really loud, and mm-hmm. Lee was kind of lost in the mix, and so you couldn't actually hear what he's saying as well,
yeah,
which is a real shame, because he's got some Weeds Downtown, Flags, mm-hmm. Kudzu and Concrete. There's some real gems in there. And yet, like you said, that really comes out when you go to the show.
And I think that was a really strategic decision by him that for a couple of reasons, and I'm going to venture out on a limb here. One reason I think I've tested by asking him is that I felt as though he buried the vocals, so you'd have to go look them up.
Ah,
and it was kind of go do your research. But I think it was also a pushback against that first album, which was very beautiful and melodic,
yes,
and very Southern in the way that people think of Southern rock. But this one was Southern in the way that people may not think, in especially punk. And that second album was almost harsh to listen to, but just embedded with these much more political songs and Southern politics, especially. And then his most recent studio album, he and the Glory Fires put out Youth Detention, like you were talking about. And that one is amazing. It's just a jample. It's a double album, but there's not too many wasted moments, dare say.
It's a double album. Almost listening through it, it kind of, this is not like some weird backhanded compliment, it doesn't sound like a double album, because sometimes in double albums, like, you're sitting there and you're like, how long have I been listening to this?
Yep.
I do not get that sense at all. It really pushes you forward. One thing you kind of made me, this is something I wanted to say, and you reminded me about this with talking about how the lyrics are specifically embedded in Southern politics and Southern issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of people only remember up here, only remember that I'm from Alabama when mm-hmm. when Alabama does something stupid. And then they all remember.
Mm. Which is often.
Which
thanks.
Is often. But that's kind of the and even the understanding of, because obviously something that, that Lee does a lot of work with is race and racism and the way that that yes. works. And they don't have, because racism, I mean, you'll have folks up here that are, you know, just racist, but really a lot of the racism is in the redlining and things like that. Because of that, they kind of have this idea that racism in the South is all that Bull Connor, you know, just
the old school racism.
Yep, just virulent and violently up front. So these albums are really cool for me because they are, I think, through the art, he gets so intimately with, no, this is what we're dealing with right now. Like where we have, golly, Good Old Boy. Mm-hmm. 140 minute and 40 seconds just talking about how you know, you that kids in school, black kids and white kids, are getting treated different when they get sent to the principal's office or don't, and, which is a, yeah. something that happens up here and might hopefully, like you said, prompt some introspection, but at the same time people up here almost kind of are shocked that somebody from Alabama who obviously loves it so much is willing to just kind of rip it up like that, call it out.
Yeah, and I'm glad you used the word intimate, because some of those songs are quite political, and his shows are even more political in a good
yes.
way for me, in my opinion. But there's a certain intimacy to his lyrics that also make you realize that the change starts with you. I know that sounds cliche. That sounded really. Let me do that again. but like the change, you know, like let's take a song, I Can Change.
Yep.
Which he has a t-shirt out now with that phrase on it. It's awesome. But that change sounds like an aim for our country should be headed for. But also it's enlightening for anyone who thinks they're also stuck in a rut personally. You know, it kind of works on a couple, if not three different levels.
Yeah. I'm so excited to be seeing this show, because to sound very dorky, all the shows that I've been at, even when like there's obvious like anger,
mm-hmm.
I don't walk out feeling they feel hopeful. Not, I mean, they're angry, but it's not kind of like the nihilist anger, right? Like nothing can change. What's the point?
Yeah.
You called it earlier kind of a movement, and this is. When you said mm-hmm. movement, and I remembered I had said that they're such a listening to that this album today, they have such a beat going through them. The music connects with kind of this get up and move, take action. We can do, you can do this kind of attitude. And I feel yeah. like I walked out of the show feeling I've always walked out of their shows feeling like energized.
Yes. And not just energized like that was a great show, but energized like that was. There was love involved with some of the statements, but there was also, you need to take a look in the mirror and you can change kind
yeah.
of thing.
Energized like I'm, you know, the kind of energized, like I'm going to go, you know, start working on a project, whatever that project might be.
Right.
Like I'm also kind of energized in the sense that like, wait a minute, like a lot of other people care about this stuff that maybe I care about. Or are thinking about this and are working through these same issues.
That's really funny you put it like that, because I told Lee after his show Friday night, I said, I haven't been around, I haven't had the chance to be around this many like-minded people in a while in the same venue where everybody was thinking, you know, where we are as a country and where we've been as Southerners just isn't cutting it. But there are, but it's not done. It's not over.
That's the thing, is it's not, you know, it, like, the, yeah, like, there's, that's such a good way to say it. Like, there's sadness and anger, but I don't listen to this album and just feel bummed out. Like, I feel, I don't know, like, it makes me, it puts me in mind of the people that I know around me who look around and say, this sucks. What am I going to do about it? And they may not do something huge, but they do something little.
Mm-hmm.
And those little things add up.
And, you know, little as in vote the right way.
Vote the right way.
Or maybe put a campaign sticker on your lunchbox.
I'm incredibly, yeah. Or like we have a little university in the town where I live, which is Willimantic, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And there's some kids there who found out that their classmates were struggling with food insecurity.
Oh, man.
And they did a little thing, which was they started a little pantry with no support from the school where people could just walk in and take things. And, you know, you didn't have to, you could just take whatever they had there. And it's growing. And that feels really hopeful to me, finding out that kids care enough about their classmates.
Yeah.
To help them feels hopeful and inspiring and like, okay, I don't just have to lie down and die in the mud in the same way that listening to this record does. Those are two in my head. They're in the same hemisphere of my brain, I guess.
Right. So do you have a favorite song over his catalog?
You know, I think this is just because I gave myself Stockholm syndrome. But those of you who have ever heard my voice on the radio will remember that Adam Morrow and I at one time had a radio show that at the University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
We did one local song and then two extra songs, but we were technically a local music show, and we were heavily focused on
Alabama music.
Focused. Especially yeah. Tuscaloosa music, but heavily focused on Alabama. And we were so desperate for music that we took literally everything, including some crap we didn't like. Lee Baines is not crap we didn't like, by the way.
Nope.
So when we got his album, that first album, There Is a Bomb in Gilead, hadn't even come out yet. And we got the song Everything You Took to play on that radio show.
Uh-huh.
We were over the moon. So I think just because I have heard it so many times and I like it, I think it's got such a cool, I don't know, it's got a good beat, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everything You Took is probably my favorite one, just from repetition. Underneath the Sheets of White Noise, I
Ooh,
think might
good
be
one.
And kind of out of and I have more like favorites from every album. Nail Your Feet, My Feet to the South Side of Town. honestly, I haven't necessarily heard a lot of people say this, but I have a real soft spot for I Heard God.
Oh yeah,
but yes,
that is such a good one. He didn't play that one live Friday, so it kind of slipped out of my mind over the weekend. That's a really good one.
Part of the problem for me with liking these songs is I think Deconstructed and Youth Detention – sorry, is pulling out one song – is Deconstructed and Youth Detention honestly work so well as albums that it's almost hard. They kind of – and not in a negative way. The songs kind of blend into each other because all the songs make up a really good album. So if I sit down and listen to it, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that one, that one, that one. But these are more like albums where I sit down and I know I'm really going to – like if I got a long car trip, these are car trip albums because I like just about every song on them.
They're very cohesive.
Yes.
Yeah. And you could tell that they were written maybe as a series or together at least. I don't know how much of a series they were written, but if I'm not mistaken, when I talk to Lee – He will tell me I'm working on an album, and I think what he's saying to me is he's working on a batch of songs that will work, that will go together.
Okay, that makes sense, because even like the kind of the ideas that he's that are being worked through, they kind of feel like they're all in the same place, right? Like
yes.
like I'm he Like, he kind of got you know, that's at least the way it feels. Yeah, they're very cohesive is the correct word.
And what I think happened with youth detention, which I found so spectacular, was that he took some of those themes from Deconstructed and internalized them. And that, to me, had such an emotional impact on me. Like that song, you mentioned it a couple times now, Nail My Feet Down on the South Side of Town. When I first heard that song, it had such resonance. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say I weeped after hearing that one the first time. And songs don't do that to me hardly anymore since I've come up out of my teenage years. And it did it. And it was a synthesis of the music, the words, and the melody. And there's this hint of piano in the back. And it struck me as amazing. And then he played that one Friday night and told a story of a deceased friend that he and I both knew quite well. And it was emotionally cathartic and draining at the same time, but such a good song.
I gotta say, I don't think this is something folks really bring up too much when talking about this band, but South Side of Town, I think Lee's singing just about never got it's as good as I've ever heard it, because he really, I don't know. He's not farting it. He's not farting it out here. It's one that I'm like, this is one of those songs that I share with people when I'm trying to convince them that this band from Alabama might actually be worth listening to.
Yeah. When he sings, I'm Stuck at the end, it's kind of a half sing, half shout, but it's singing. It's not much shouting. I shouldn't say shout, but he did that on live Friday, and it shook the room.
Oh, I'm excited to see them play. I'm gonna be the space they're gonna be in is a brewery space, so it's gonna be pretty muddy, which I think is gonna be
Sonic.
Good,
you mean?
Yeah. It's got low ceilings, or not super not super high ceilings, so it's gonna be pretty muddy. But
I think the place I saw him in could be compared to a garage.
Okay.
Someone opened their garage and the front garage door was open, and not quiet. It was a cool place. It was a nice venue, but it had a DIY feel to it. So. Anything else you want to comment on Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires?
Well, I'm personally excited. So I was already planning to go to this show. One in Hartford, because they're coming close, and you know they're from home, and I want to see them, and I kind of know Lee. I don't know if he knows me, but I know who he is. And got a text from Adam Morrow saying, "How far away do you live from Hartford?"
Mm-hmm. And how far away do you live?
I'm about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on where. So I'm pretty close. Come to find out, he is going to be playing, or has been playing guitar, is going to be playing guitar, on this tour. So I had another reason to go to something I was already going to. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see how that sounds, because he is a really good guitarist.
He is a professional.
He really knows his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And in case anyone's wondering and listening, he is a guitar player for John Paul White and has his own bands, Delray and Speckled Bird, that are worth the time. Very, some good music going on with all of his projects. But yeah, he's playing with Lee. Fantastic. Shout out to Adam Williamson and Blake Williamson. They are the rhythm section you mentioned earlier.
Oh, they're good.
They're good. Okay.
All right.
Let's wrap on Lee. If you're listening to Taking It Down from the Alabama Take, you've heard of Lee Baines. So who am I to tell you to go listen to him? All right.
I guess I do have one comment. The only thing that really is against him in my book is that he's such a huge fan of Liberty football. I don't understand it. I don't know where it doesn't seem to fit in with where he is politically. But you know, if Coach Hugh Freeze and the Liberty Flames, you know, if you're out there, you got a fan in Lee Baines.
An undying devotion. All right.
Yes.
All right, let's take a break. Thanks, Donovan. We'll get back in just a second with a Netflix show, Unbelievable. So we'll take a break. All right, a quick thanks for tuning in, downloading, listening, however you got here. We're going to talk about that Netflix show, Unbelievable, in just a bit. But if you're interested in getting in touch with us, please drop us a line at thealabamatake@gmail.com. There's a lot to find at the website, thealabamatake.com. This time of year, we cover college football a little bit here and there for shits and giggles, so to speak. And there's, of course, the main podcast. That one's called The Alabama Take. Uniquely named. So you can find it in a separate feed in your podcast app, which you'll want to do, because it's chock full of great stories and interviews with Alabama artists like Lee Banks III, though he hasn't been on there yet, but people like that and beyond. For both Taking It Down and the Alabama Take Pod, search us out. We are on all podcast aggregators, but you can reach us on social media too, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We don't have a Snapchat because, Jesus Christ, we're not 13. We will, let's get back into it, though, in just a couple of seconds. We'll be back with Donovan and the Netflix show Unbelievable. Okay, we're back. Yeah, we're going to be talking about Netflix show. We're going to change gears here. You know, you joked about pets dying, but we're going to get into even darker material here. Darker, but certainly resonant and important. We're going to be talking about Netflix show Unbelievable that appeared on the service Friday, September 13th. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to watch that. I've had the opportunity to watch all of it. Donovan, have you watched all of it?
I finished it last night.
As did I. And so maybe we'll kind of loosely touch on it to begin, and then once we get into specifics of the episodes, I'll kind of give a spoiler alert if anybody's listening and wants to shut it down and then come back when they've watched. So, but it's a vital series to me. It was horrifying without being scary. Not quite, you know, like a scary show, but here's what we got going on. It's almost two shows in one. It starts with, in the immediate aftermath of this young college age girl, her rape in Washington in 2008. And then the entire episode of the first is sort of just the procedures that are part of a rape case. And then it goes off into like a totally other show, or it feels like a totally other show. And it jumps to Colorado 2011 at another rape. But it's a completely different investigator, and we're going to get into some of that. And it's all based on the true stories from reporting by ProPublica and the Marshall Project. And those two storylines sort of run along parallel, though in different timelines, obviously. And even though the Me Too movement has kind of become a few people's go-to punchline of late, this show feels not like a response to that, but more like a evolution or exploration of those kinds of things, the importance of those kinds of things without, you know, getting into the levity of them without getting into the punchline of it, I guess you could say. So, yeah, what do you think, Donovan, just in general, and then maybe we can get into episode, because it's hard to talk about without talking about those first two episodes especially.
It is. You really kind of summed up a lot of kind of my initial impressions of the show, especially, so a couple things really struck me. First off, boy, that first episode is hard to watch. I was a little leery about going into this one because, it's pretty. I mean, it's pretty. They treat because they do, and the actors do such a good job of kind of conveying just the seriousness of what's happened. It is hard, and
it's hard in a way that it's not explicit or.
Yes.
What's the word I'm looking for? Where you kind of use something to kind of get viewers' attention because it's graphic. It's not graphic.
Yeah, it's not sensationalized.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah. I was really struck the first episode, and this is kind of going to the specifics, but really.
Okay. So, yeah.
Off of what you said, where it's really not – it felt very even and measured as they're just going – through here is what happens to somebody who has been raped and is now the subject of or part of an investigation, right? The going to the hospital, telling your story multiple times.
Yeah, it's very procedural. Like
it is very and it's almost traumatizing how
yeah.
procedural it is, because this is just kind of just people doing their jobs, really.
Absolutely.
I was struck, too, by kind of, or at least the effect that sometimes the two narratives had on me, is as you're going through and you're watching the other detectives with the other rape case, and you're getting excited because they're solving stuff, it jumps back to Marie. And every time you kind of get, well, you have that, like, excitement, like, wow, we're getting somewhere. It goes back to her, and you're almost kind of brought down because you're seeing the pain that she is going through and that she's living with. And that was kind of interesting too. It kept it from being like, I don't know, some of these shows were like, you know, they're trying to catch a serial killer or something and it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's like a game.
Yep.
You know, yeah, and it helped it being overly simplistic. It kept it away from that. I felt.
Well, yeah. Let's go ahead and talk specifics here. So if you haven't watched, we'll kind of draw the spoiler line right here and say, come back and pick it up right here at this minute. The first person that we get the first episode in 2008 is Marie Adler. She's played by Caitlin Dever, who was in Booksmart this summer. Did you see that?
I did not see it.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I didn't see anything this summer.
Yeah,
not even stuff I wanted to see.
Oh, I understand. But she's it's such a tonal shift for her. She's a high school. She's a senior in that movie, high school senior, and she's, you know, pretty fun loving, studying and whatnot. And here we get Marie Adler, who's been tossed around in foster homes her childhood, and now she's on her own finally, and this happens to her, this rape, and we get the breakdown, like you talked about, the procedures. And I wouldn't have known what happens to someone who's had a sexual assault. So just that was eye-opening. But, and then it took me, I think, 3 episodes to realize, oh, these are different timelines. There's 3 years difference. So, like you were talking about, the hunt for the rapist wasn't going to have a incredibly happy ending for Marie, who was 3 years in the past. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think the only thing that signaled to me that the Marie one was before was she had a flip phone.
Yes, they made strategic use of the flip phone, because when toward the end of the series, when she finally catches up, and as far as the timeline goes, she gets an iPhone at the end.
Yes, so she, yeah.
That's
because everyone has an iPhone now, you know.
You're right.
Although I think one of her foster moms had a smartphone, so they were, you know.
Oh,
they
okay.
were, yeah. I got very focused in on the phones, as you
can
tell.
I did too. No, you weren't the only one. And I do that in so many shows. Okay, we're going to get tangential here, but that's okay. I do that. And so I always think, where did they find an original iPhone to film this show?
Yes. I'm wondering about the flip phone too, because I'm like all these things are broken now. I also wonder about that.
I think
especially
the flip phone's
going
to be easier,
like,
to find than the original iPhone.
Do you think? Yeah, I'm kind of curious whenever shows find these props that are from kind of like the recent past, mm-hmm. where it's like nobody's saving the things yet. They're just trash.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Where do you, I mean, I don't know. I guess you go to the Salvation Army or whatever.
I guess. Anyway, this show does, after last night wrapping it up and watching it, it struck me as openly and positively feminist. And I get the irony of two white guys sitting here talking about feminism in a way, which, you know, that certainly men can be feminist. That's a great thing. But other than 3 episodes, I think it's 8 episode series. So 5 episodes were directed by ladies. It's almost solely written by women. The show itself is as much about women in charge and doing much better than dudes in charge. And it kind of shines a light on how most guys don't know how to process or think about rape and sexual assault.
Yep. And not only that, it just felt very – the whole thing is grounded in – or foregrounded in experiences that various women are having, whether it's the women that are victims who – or whether it's the police officers or whatever. It's kind of this is going to be a weird comparison, so hold on to your hats.
Do
it's
it.
Kind of like with what the show Gilmore Girls did, where it didn't really care about the interiority as much of its male characters. It was so, because it was so foregrounded in its women characters. And I kind of felt like that, like the male characters kind of came in and came out, but it was really in and out, really interesting on what's going on inside Marie, what's going on inside the detectives, what are their quiet moments, you know, what are they sharing with each other, what's that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a couple of great scenes with the two female detectives in the 2011 case who are tracking down this serial rapist who happens to be the guy who raped Marie in 2008. And I bet there's some, if you're listening to this podcast and you've gotten to this point and you think, well, and you're a dude and you think to yourself, I don't, that doesn't interest me. I only want to hear what dudes think or what guys do. First of all, fuck off. Second of all, you'd be surprised what you can learn from other people beyond who you are, you know. Episode one is two old white guys, and there's a metaphor for you. These two older white guys who, and they do the investigating of Marie's sexual assault. Like I said, it's the aftermath of that. And they aren't like evil or incompetent, but they're just juxtaposed with this female detective who appears in episode two, who's doing that rape case, played by Merritt Weaver. And it's just such this contrast. Like, she has such a caring, gentle, measured approach to handling the case, because they're dealing with a victim and not just a case. But the guys from the first episode, they weren't abusive or rude, but they just, it's such a difference. It's a nuanced difference too.
That is kind of exactly what I thought too. As soon as we have, sorry, you just said her name and I lost her. She was
Merritt Weaver.
Thank you, Merritt Weaver. She was excellent.
And I only knew her from The Walking Dead, by the way. And
I didn't know she was in that. I watched Godless, which I did not like, but she was very good in that.
I got you.
And it was the care. Mm-hmm. And the we're going at your pace, not my pace, that she took with her first victim. Whereas the police officers in Seattle, which I completely agree and thought was really interesting, like these are two guys, the detectives investigating Marie's case, two guys who are really doing what they think is the best they can. They are not villainous, right? Like they're not, but they just screw it up so badly. And I thought because Marie, they start to get some information about Marie, and Marie is, you know, has been very, very, had a very traumatic experience, so kind of her stories don't match up, and there's some stuff going on there. And they just, she doesn't fit what they start to think is happening. She doesn't fit their narrative. And I thought, like, that was such a good, like, a good line, such a tricky but good line to watch. I thought the acting throughout this whole series was consistently excellent.
Yes,
and part of that was conveyed with this, because you don't want to like give these guys a pass, because obviously what happened was very serious. But if they're just kind of cartoonishly villainous, like mm-hmm. Why did this happen? Because they're just bad people, and bad people do bad things. I think it kind of cuts down on any reflection you could have for yourself, because most of us don't think of ourselves as bad people. We think of ourselves as good people trying to do our best, which these guys definitely were, and they screwed it up.
And they're not, I mean, you already have the villain, which is the rapist.
Yeah.
If you need a show with an antagonist, there it is. But you're right, the acting was so good. That guy who plays the main detective, he's bald, but he played a character named Lyle from Escape from Dannemora on Showtime last year.
Okay.
And he was just a cuckolded buffoon, and he had fake teeth in, and I thought to myself, who is this guy? He's kind of hilarious, but he's also doing such a good job acting. And then he shows up in this show, and he's just a straight arrow kind of guy who, you're right, he's just not working with the precision he needs, and maybe not working with a 100% heart. Where maybe 85% heart, maybe 80% heart, and just saying, okay, well, this isn't working out. Let me move on to my next case. It's understandable. That's how I do my job on some days. I'm just like, this isn't working, so I'm going to move on. Rather than saying, no, there are humans involved.
That's exactly, I feel like they portrayed him as, again, not a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Seems to actually genuinely care for Marie and feel bad for her. But also, like, and, he knows in his head, that rape victims or people who go through trauma, memories are often jumbled up, but it doesn't really as soon as things are just kind of like right and maybe not right or whatever, he's on to the next case, or he thinks they're not right. He's on to the next case. His, like you said, no, the heart wasn't in it. Cause who knows what could have been found if they looked a little further. Yeah. And just it was interesting too. Just even the, I'm sure there's much that could be made of this. Maybe even just with the way we talk about sexual assault or educate ourselves. But the foster mother,
mm-hmm.
who says I think she might be making this up, also says that she was raped, and so she knows or was assaulted. I don't know if she was raped. Yeah,
you wonder if
right
she had a similar experience as far as people believing her.
Yeah, what's the internalization, or what's it even, you know, often this is something where I have read that the experiences that people who've gone through trauma such as this have strike people as inappropriate. They'll laugh or smile. They'll do all these odd things. So both stepmoms didn't really know. Long story short, there were not really any villains in this movie. Show except for the obvious villain, the rapist, who is a villain. Everyone else seemed like they were very, very extremely well-meaning people trying to do their best, she just was failed at every step of the way.
That's
and
right.
And then she got into the system, and the system is not there to protect or uphold her. It's there to punish.
To me, Marie Adler served as a testament to something I don't know if I've seen on TV often or I consider a lot. It's those who already have a ton of shit going on that they can't really control, like being in a foster home or being orphaned or losing their job or whatever. They can't handle even more shit given to them.
Yeah.
And it could be a breaking point that put them in the justice system or almost with no help at all. So you see people in court for a pile of parking tickets. And, you know, you just don't know what they came from. And that sounds overly, I don't know if there's such a thing as overly sympathetic, but it sounds so hokey maybe, but that's true.
No, it's true. It's such a, that's such an excellent point. I kind of was thinking somewhat something similar too, where Marie, just because like, she seems to have no idea almost of, like what the norms of like adult life are. That's mm-hmm. not quite right, but just cause it's so obvious. She's figuring this all out for herself in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. And she's going from being a kid to an adult. And if there's no, you know, if there's no one there that, geez, even just like, it's not that people aren't portrayed as being not sympathetic towards her, but there's no one there that just really, really seemed like they were in her corner 100%.
Yeah.
It was tough. And the woman who plays Marie, I felt like she was really not chewing the scenery at all. It was kind of a muted performance, which made me really impressed with how good I thought she was.
Yeah. And once again, I use her performance in Booksmart, like I did with the detective from earlier to me, I figure out a person's a good actor or actress when I see them in something else. So,
absolutely.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think it was kind of eye-opening for me that all the victims weren't young college ladies, you know, which is saying to the audience that rape and sexual assault are much more about power and
sure.
not about sex. You know, there was a victim who was an older lady who kept the house for a fraternity.
Yep.
And that to me, and you know, it wasn't like your she's under 35, thin blonde lady. She was, you know, she wasn't elderly per se. Maybe close by technical terms, age wise, numbers wise, she might have been close to being elderly. But she was just this motherly figure, pretty literally, pretty figuratively as well. And she experienced the exact same treatment as Marie Adler did, who was like 18 at the time.
I'm trying to say this in a way that isn't a jackass thing to say, but you know, so often when we hear about something like this, you folks say, well, why was she out so late at night, or why was her door unlocked, or
why was she wearing that?
What was she wearing? Yeah, and I feel like, I mean, obviously, these folks are based off of real people that had this happen to, but it really seemed like that part of the show, what it was getting at was, it's really not about you, right? Like the older woman at the sentencing of the rapist says, "What was I doing that made you pick me?" But it's not them. They didn't do anything. It's about him. It's about that power and control and domination, right? Like, you didn't do anything wrong. He did something wrong. So that kind of seemed, hopefully I got that across in the way.
Yeah.
It's really about his desire to harm and dominate.
Yeah, and he even says that he's not comfortable around women.
Yep, absolutely. Also, shout out to Ken from Mad Men as the good brother.
I was so worried that Ken Cosgrove.
Honestly, me too.
I was like, don't be the rapist, Ken Cosgrove from Mad Men.
I was terrified. I'm like, Ken, like, maybe you weren't the best dude on Mad Men, but you know, you were fine. I had a soft spot in my heart for you. Please don't get arrested for this.
Yeah.
No, he was fine. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, and we're kind of getting close to the ending, but it fit. I think it was a nice but not incredibly tidy, but it was still, it allowed almost all of those ladies to have a win, sort of. Ugh, that's an awful word, isn't it?
I know what you mean.
It was tidy in a way that didn't betray the sort of show it wanted to be.
I think I agree with that.
So the guy gets sentenced for he gets sentenced for 325.5 years, I think is the exact number.
Yep.
Which is great, but that doesn't help with the sweet teas out there. You remember him from Tuscaloosa, T.J. Bunn Jr.? Remember this guy?
I do. I remember all of the – yeah, I've forgotten about it until you just brought it back up.
Okay, so if he's listening, fuck you. But if he's if he's not listening and you know him, send him this podcast so he can hear. Fuck you. But this is a guy who probably raped several girls in Tuscaloosa, college age girls, and because his family was powerful and rich, nothing happened to him. And one of his victims shot herself. She committed suicide. I'm not sure how. And BuzzFeed reported on it. And it's like the lawyer said in the last episode, summarized it perfectly when he said it. I said, yep, that's it. When people come up to the police and say, I've been robbed by gunpoint, help me get my wallet back.
I wrote that down too in my little book.
Yeah.
Which I left downstairs.
No, but who says, I don't believe you. You threw your wallet in the trash can. I'm not going to help you. But yet when ladies come and say, this guy touched me inappropriately or raped me, you know, you have this group of people who say, yeah, but.
Right.
Or I don't believe you. Sometimes I get flat out awful and say, I don't believe you. And it's such a touchy, it can be such a touchy subject for obvious reasons. But at the same time, I think our first instinct should be, we need to believe the victim and figure out what to do after that moment. After
absolutely.
Believing.
I mean, you know, and this not only, you know, we kind of see in the show with what you know, kind of all her friends turn on Marie after they think she's lied. But, you know, this kind of this attitude of, you know, what were you wearing, for lack of a better word? Mm-hmm. You know, the real world consequences of that is you'll have women that have been abused in either sexually or physically, and they'll go in and be making reports. And it is apparently not uncommon even for police officers to be like, are you sure? Are you sure that it wasn't X? Yeah. They, you know, they even, there's so many kind of the ones who got away in this show. We have our police officer who's a domestic abuser, and he's getting away with it. We have the college student who gets taken into the police station because...
Who at worst is way too pushy.
Yeah, exactly.
Excuse me, at best.
At best is way too pushy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's somebody else who knows it says he forces girls to have sex with them. And I thought it was something else I made a little note of is... He's saying he rapes them, and the guy says, "No, no, no, no. That's not what I'm saying. He does." And they're like, "Well, that's the definition of rape." Right. And even it was kind of a good like sit and think with it moment. Like you've got this guy who is trying to bring forward actionable evidence, who is unwilling to admit just what he's saying that this guy does, and presumably he's going to get away with it.
And it made me think, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of this Me Too stuff that's been going on in the last 2 or 3 years has made me think, too. Like, where was I? Where do I need to reel it in and not be so maybe inappropriate? And hopefully that's as bad as I ever got. I was just inappropriate.
No, and
it's,
you know,
it's tough.
To go back to our Lee Baines thing.
Yeah.
It's never too late to change.
That's right.
Because
that's
exactly
what I was thinking.
I think there are times, you know, I think there are times where, like, it's not like anyone ever told you whatever was okay, but like you know, you get older and you listen to people and you think, whoa, that wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what am I gonna do about it now?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. And there's I think I'm getting close to the end of my thoughts. I will say one more thing that I feel like the show is also a lesson on how investigative reporting is much needed. Not that these cases went unchecked or went under the radar, but ProPublica and the Marshall Project reporting that did make it into a show and did educate me a little bit, you know?
Oh man, absolutely. Have you read the articles?
No, have you?
Yes.
How long are they?
Not very long. I mean, they're a long read, but the ProPublica one, well, you probably spend maybe 30 minutes on it.
Interesting. Yeah, I may look those up this week, and maybe our listeners will too. Good.
The ProPublica one is very, very interesting, and I stumbled. Well, I was doing a little reading for the show, and I found that one of the reporters too, actually, with the permission of Marie, shared her thoughts about the show.
Oh, I did see that.
Yeah.
That I did see today.
Mm-hmm. Which was cool too. Apparently she's seen it. She liked the show.
And it helped her to find some closure.
And she said that the Caitlin Dever who plays her in the show captured her struggle to put her feelings and thoughts into words. Which I thought was, this is kind of a tangent going back to it, but I thought kind of as we're, I don't know, we're almost talking about, like, there's almost, I was sitting watching the show, and I thought, you know, like, wow, you know, Amber's so cool, like, she remembered all this stuff, she really helped the investigation, and I'm sitting there kind of mulling with that, and I'm thinking, like, what is, if I'm saying that Amber is, quote unquote, the good victim because she remembered all this stuff and helped the investigation. What am I thinking about Marie? It made me really reflect on the way we and myself especially can, you know, if you are not good, just the constant asking her to tell her story over again and she has to write it down. If you are not accomplished at putting your thoughts and ideas into words, or you're not in a place where you're able to do that, sometimes we fail you. We think that you're not as good or whatever. So that was, seeing that was kind of an intro. It gave me food for thought about even just thinking about the way we fail those who are not as accomplished at expressing themselves or right. not able to.
Right. Well, it's a challenging show in a good way. It should challenge most viewers, I think, and maybe even cause us all to be aware of some of these things that we've never considered and have been lucky not to consider. But so I think that's it. You got any more thoughts on Unbelievable?
It was good. Everyone should watch it if they feel that they can stomach it, because it is tough.
Yeah.
But it's
good.
If
you made it this far, we might have spoiled some.
Yeah,
bunch
that's true.
Things, but it's only 8 episodes long, so yeah.
On top of that, oh man, Toni Collette last is talking about range. Last time I saw her, she was losing her mind in Hereditary, and now she's tough as nails, badass.
That's exactly the last thing I saw her in, and I don't know that I was really aware of her work until Hereditary, and shame that we haven't brought her up until now.
I know. Well, there's a lot of good stuff to talk about. Well, quote unquote, good. There's a lot of good stuff to talk about with the show. You really could go on and on about it.
Yeah. In fact, I was even going to go on. It's so well done that I was going to talk about the title sequence, that short title sequence that fades in on the word
"Oh,
live."
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's speaking volumes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
it's good.
It's good. Let's wrap up here. And thanks, Donovan, for joining us. We'll have to get you on again, man. You were great.
A pleasure. I've had a blast. I got to think about something and talk about something.
Yeah, that's always a good thing.
Always a good thing.
People.
Do better, more of
okay.
that.
Okay. All right, that is the end of episode 7. We're going to be back in 2 weeks with more of what's ever on our mind. But, in fact, if you have a show, movie, set of songs, whatever you want us to cover, talk about, you can let us know. And if we have time, we might do it. Or it might already be on our radar. Holler at thealabamatake@gmail.com or find us all over social media under the Alabama Take moniker. We hope to hear from you guys, and we hope that you hear from us. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks, everyone.